היא שכחה להתחתן בחיים. למה? עבודה, עבודה, עבודה.
נסעה לחומוס. תסתכל כמה יש לבנים בשק.
That's Suela, a Muslim chef in the Israeli city of Akkar. Her friend says she's not married because she's always working. And her reply? I'm married to hummus. That's from Hummus, the movie, a documentary that follows a few different Middle Eastern chefs on their quest for the perfect hummus. It'll be showing in the Kansas City Jewish Film Festival on January 22nd. So today we're going to hear from one of the chefs in the film, as well as two local women with hummus stories of their own. This kicks off our first Friday art show here on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'd like to introduce Chef Jalil Dabit with us by phone from Samir Restaurant in Ramla, Israel. Hi, Jalil.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. Actually, I'm really good. We are preparing for our Christmas.
Your Christmas?
Tonight. Yeah, for us, we are Greek Orthodox, so we have a different calendar. So in a few hours, the house will be full of people, Jewish, Muslim, and Christian. We will celebrate Christmas.
Wow. What time is it there?
Now it's, I think it's 6 or 6:30, like 8 hours before you.
Okay, so...
Okay.
Well, let's see. Were you surprised when a filmmaker approached you for an entire documentary all about hummus?
Yes, actually it was really an accident. Like they looking for a place with a story, place with that making hummus for a long, long time. And they met my uncle in a place, and my uncle told them that you have to go to Samir's restaurant. They have a really good hummus and they have a really good story. So they come after 1 hour. They come. We met, and he decided, yes, let's do the movie.
What is your story? What's the story that had intrigued him?
Okay, the story, it starts for a long time ago. We are like in family, in restaurants, in motel, in hostel for more than 400 years.
Your family is?
My family, yes. And we're in the area of Israel, traveling for more than 700 years. So we have like a lot of history, and we opened, my grandfather opened the restaurant in Ramle. Okay, it's a small city between Tel Aviv and Jaffa, and Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, sorry. And he opened there, the restaurant, after 1948. And my
1948, the founding of Israel.
Yeah, after the war. He had a restaurant before Israel, and he have a restaurant after Israel, like in Israel. In 1948, he opened the new restaurant. And since then, until now, we have a restaurant that four generations actually work in this restaurant. And we have a customer that coming five generations to the restaurant.
So when the restaurant opened, it was in a place called Palestine, and now it continues to exist in a place called Israel. Same place?
Yes, it's the same place.
What would you say, I mean, beyond it being a business, what is the role of hummus in your family or on your table?
It's the king of the salads, you know?
The salads?
It's the king. We have the salads, yes. All the salads. Hummus is it's the basic of the Arabic or the Israeli food, really. But the hummus... It's the thing that you can top on it a lot of things, and you can mix it with a lot of things. It's what amazing in hummus, it's that it's really healthy if you don't eat the pita bread next to it.
But, what do you eat it with instead of pita bread?
You can eat an onion.
Just dip an onion in hummus?
Yeah, dip an onion in hummus or vegetable. And at the beginning you say that I'm in Samir's in Ramle. But we also opened a restaurant in Berlin 1.5 years ago. His name, the restaurant is called there Canaan. Canaan, it's the promised land, right?
Yeah.
And it's there in Berlin. It's Israeli-Palestinian restaurant. And it's a vegan and vegetarian restaurant. And it's the basic on hummus. So we have a lot of things we put on hummus that the German like. For example, sweet potato or pumpkin or stuff like rote bete.
And so that's it's all really mixed nice. Into the hummus with the basic ingredients. I mean, so you have the chickpeas, the tahini, maybe some lemon and oil, and then pumpkin?
No, the oil, it's the oil, it's topic. But when we make the hummus, we use five ingredients. We use the chickpeas, the tahini, lemon, salt, and water.
No That's oil?
It. No oil. Oil wow. We put after.
Hmm.
And if you want to put cumin, you can put cumin after. When you make the hummus, when you make the cream, then you can put on top whatever you want, like hot chickpeas or beans. Or pumpkin, or salad, or meat, or whatever you want.
What is it
and
like?
That's what's beautiful in hummus.
Yeah, I mean, what is it like to carry on your family's culinary tradition? I mean, hundreds of years old culinary tradition, not just in your restaurant in Ramla, but in Berlin, on another continent with an entirely different culture and history.
Yes, it's really nice. It's not easy. I'm always fighting with myself if it's traditionally or not, if it's too much fusion, if I like losing my roots. But until now, I'm thinking that I'm doing the job pretty good, and I'm really like traveling from the West and the East all the time, from the Arab, German, Israeli, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, all the time. And I think I'm trying to do my best, and I hope that people like it, and I think that people like it.
A lot of hummus here in the United States is made with chickpeas that come out of a can. What do you think about that?
It's not. You can do it, okay? But it's not taste like a real hummus.
What's the difference in the taste?
Because when you put it on in when it's in cane, they put some stuff on it to make it like to preserve this, right? And when you make it fresh, when you buy the chickpeas dry and you soak them in water for 12 hours and then you clean the water and then you boil it and you see all the, you know, what you put inside and it's real and it's fresh and it's not something that it's in can for 6 months or 1 year, you know? It's different taste. Just different taste. You can come over. I have, and after the movie, we're gonna make like a dinner. And I will make hummus, so we can come and try it, and you will tell me what's the difference.
Okay, you're gonna do that in Kansas City.
Yes.
That's so exciting. Do you care personally? I mean, what culture kind of originated hummus? I mean, you've kind of touched on that there are a lot of different religious groups living kind of in the same place and that there can be tension between these groups, but that everyone eats hummus. Do you care whose food hummus was originally?
I care and I don't care. And that's why we call the restaurant, the new restaurant that we opened in Berlin, we call it Canaan. Canaan, it's the promised land. It's before Israel. It's before Palestine. It's like really the beginning of when the Jewish start to be a people, you know, and Christian wasn't before. It's before everything. And I don't care, actually. I care just that people like hummus and want hummus and want to eat a good food, you know. And I care that if it's, I'm pretty sure that it's from this region, from Palestine, Israel, Syria, and Lebanon. That's the region of the hummus, you know?
It so belongs to the place.
Yes, it belongs to the place. It's not belong to one religious or other people, you know? It's food.
Yeah. Well, Chef Jalil Dabit, thank you so much for chatting with me today. Your hummus sounds really good. The pumpkin sounds interesting, and I'm excited for you to come to Kansas City.
Okay, thank you. Me too.
We're joined.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're joined now in the studio by two women who are part of the Sisterhood of Salam Shalom here in Kansas City. That's a group of Jewish and Muslim women who come together for shared cultural experiences. And among those, as we've just heard, is making and eating hummus. Ines, Eunice, good morning.
Good morning.
And Jill Madoff, hello to you.
Hi.
First of all, Ines, talk to me about hummus in your life.
Wow. Well, I think I have to take up issue with Jaleel a little bit there because I think he left out an ingredient, garlic. But I think that speaks to the fact that everybody makes hummus in their own way and no one really has a monopoly on any particular type of food. And I think we can extend that logic to a lot of things. We're all human beings and food belongs to everyone and good ideas belong to everyone. And hummus is a staple in the Arabic tradition. I grew up with hummus.
Where did you grow up?
I was originally born in Mosul, Iraq. So I spent a portion of my childhood there. But even after I came to the States, hummus has always been part of our eating rituals. And I love it. I do want to say that traditionally we always used to make it at home because you could never really buy store-bought hummus. It never really had the same flavor, or it was kind of frowned upon if you were to purchase it, especially since it's not really that difficult to make at home. But now I have to say that, you know, you can Costco makes a good brand of hummus, and I have gotten away with purchasing it rather than making it, and people never know the difference. So
talk to
we've
me
come a long way.
A little bit more about the significance of hummus on an Iraqi table. I mean, you growing up.
Yeah, I don't think that we can really make distinctions between the different cultures in terms of how they experience food or food like hummus. It's an appetizer, generally speaking. It's become wildly popular, I think, because of its health benefits, but also because more people are going vegetarian. So it was something as common in the Arabic culture as, I can't really think of a American.
Like butter,
yeah. It's something you always have on the table, and garnishing it is really actually just as critical to the presentation as the actual hummus. So we garnish it in different ways. You put dry mint, olive oil, lemon wedges, olives, and it really kind of complements the table in more than just flavor, but also appearance. It's attractive.
I went to a Middle Eastern grocery store once and bought hummus there. And the man behind the counter told me that where he came from, that you eat hummus for every meal, and that I should get some hummus for breakfast, that I should serve it at breakfast. I mean, is it really like an every meal kind of thing?
It most definitely can be. And actually, people do eat it for breakfast. So that's not uncommon. Yeah.
Jill, what about you? I mean, talk to me about hummus in your life. Is it in any way parallel, or you being primarily, you know, someone you've lived your life here? It's a little different.
As an American Jew, we enjoy hummus as Israeli fare. And so when we have Israeli style food of any kind, you can know that it's going to include hummus. And we, too, have people who advocate for one kind of preparation or another when we participate in the ethnic festival on Swope Park. That's going to be one of the pieces that we provide, so that we've come to enjoy this Mideastern fare.
What inspired both of you to join this group, Salam Shalom? I'll start with you, Jill.
Sure. I've long been involved in interfaith issues. I've been concerned about opportunities for different groups to listen to each other. We talk a lot about talking to each other, and I'm more concerned about listening to each other. When the opportunity came up to join an intimate group of women who would just celebrate holidays, share texts, talk about personal family stories, it seemed like a perfect way to learn about cultures that I didn't know a whole lot about, and it's been a real joy.
Have you had an experience since joining the group that's been in any way, I don't know, unexpected or
What's been unexpected is listening to Muslim practices, Muslim beliefs, and shaking my head and saying, whoa, that's a Jewish belief. That's a Jewish principle. That's a Jewish practice or something really close to it. And I continue, even after going into our third year, I continue to shake my head, as Ines or others will describe what they do following a death or in anticipation of a holiday or in a repentance, in the mood of repentance. And I think to myself, well, there's so many commonalities. That's what's been surprising and wonderful.
Beyond hummus.
Beyond hummus.
I'd like to ask you that same question, Ines. I mean, what inspired you to be a part of this, to want to get together with Jewish women?
Well, like Jill, I was already involved with interfaith work and interfaith activities. And this, I kind of segued into this particular group through invitation. I was invited to be the Muslim co-leader of the first Kansas City chapter in the Midwest. And that was a little over 2 years ago. And since then, now we have many Midwestern chapters. So we have grown exponentially.
But I mean on a personal level.
On a personal level, I was really inspired by the fact that this was female-driven. And we were sort of invoking the female energy to build relationships, which I think is what is missing in a lot of our conversations that tend to veer towards politics and intellectual, you know, discussions, and not really based on intimate relationship building. And the core of the sisterhood is about building intimate relationships so that if and when we do come across more difficult conversations and discussions, that there is a foundation there that allows us to persevere through
them. Have you within the group had difficult discussions?
One of the sisterhood's tenets is that we refrain from speaking about political issues for at least the first year and a half until we have formed those bonds so that they don't become deal breakers. But, you know, you can't help but come across certain situations and scenarios where difficult discussions come up, and we've had no problem navigating those shores. So I'm proud to say that my friendships within the sisterhood are some of my strongest.
Have you guys seen Hummus the movie?
I've seen significant parts of it. I'm a person who doesn't like previews. Even when I go to a movie, I block my ears.
I'm with you.
So I'm anxious to see it for the first time at the Jewish Community Center.
Do you think, I mean, what do you still want to know about hummus, the food, that you don't already know?
I'm really interested in the cultural identification with it, that and intrigued by the idea that people who create the hummus seem to take on the responsibility for creating the food of Israel and take great pride in that.
The food of Israel and of an entire region, really.
Yes.
Jill, Ines, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for
having
us.
Thank you.
Hummus the movie is showing here in town on January 22nd as part of the Kansas City Jewish Film Festival. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll talk to artist Misty Gamble about her career retrospective opening tonight in the Crossroads. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm sitting here with artist Misty Gamble. Her show opening tonight at the Lady Volkas Gallery is called Decade, 2006 to 2016. Misty, what do those 10 years represent in your life or your career?
Wow, that's a big question.
Just hit the ground running.
Wow. Okay, so it's a start and it might be an ending. You know, it's a transitionary period. It was very interesting setting up the show and pulling out these crates of art and seeing where I started and where I came from and how there's been a common thread that has like sort of drifted through the work, a continuation.
A thread that surprised you?
Yeah, I became really aware of the idea that the thread was the content of the work and the ideas that went into it, but that thread and that information, the meaning of the work has become a little bit more hidden, maybe not so in your face, the ideas have maybe become a little bit more sophisticated. And it's really wonderful to see that I've used so many different strategies and methodologies to come up with similar sort of meanings and ideas, again, back to that thread. But I've been able to be expansive in my mode of making.
Okay, so we're going to get back to those things once we know a little bit more about your story and your art.
Okay.
You are a ceramics artist. That is what I personally like to say because the word ceramist just sounds kind of funny to me sometimes. Is that okay?
I call myself a sculptor that uses clay. It's slightly different. You don't want to be a person made out of clay, a ceramic artist. but I definitely have been working in the realm of ceramics and with clay in a lot of different ways. I'm using mixed media as well these days.
How did you get into it?
Wow. How did I get into it? I studied as an undergraduate in studio arts, and I did painting and sculpture and clay. And it's funny, many of my professors when I was younger said, oh, definitely go into painting. I think that's something that you're, you know, that's something that you could follow into a master's program. But I felt like there was something sort of immediate about clay, but yet challenging at the same time. There were so many different things one could do with ceramics. And I had this natural inclination to work with a figure and figuration and the body, which makes perfect sense because I am the daughter of my father, who was an internationally celebrated puppeteer. So I grew up around bodies and motion and kinetic work, complicated marionettes and traveling and theatricality. So this sort of drive to work with the body, the figure, theater, theatrical settings and installations made sense to me.
I'm looking at your website right now, and
fabulous.
There's a series that you have called Sweet Terror.
Yes.
And speaking of puppetry, this is the series where I think I see the puppetry influence the most clearly. They're these candy-colored girls, life-size, made of clay, and they're sort of cute, but sort of scary and a little grotesque. I love them. I love them. So I don't mean any of that as like an insult.
No, it's wonderful. You're spot on.
But there's one, they're in these poses, especially this one girl she's green and, I mean, entirely green.
Yes.
Her clothes, her body, her hair, everything. And she's wearing, she's in roller skates and she's got her legs sort of splayed out on the ground. And her pose is just very marionette-like. I mean, you see her and imagine her kind of, I think, with strings attached.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was sort of the beginning of this journey. That was my MFA work. And I've been able to bring some of that work from California to be able to display it here at Lidi Volkas. And a lot of it was, like I said, more in your face when I first started.
What was it that was in your face?
The provocation.
What is the provocation here?
The provocation, it talks about upsetting the status quo, I think. I think it's engaging to the viewer, but at the same time, shall I even be looking at this? Should I be engaged? So I guess in some ways, it's questioning the viewer to question their own notions of what they believe in.
What they believe in about girls?
What they believe in about roles of both sexes, family, adornment, moving on into the rest of the show, consumerism, material waste, feminist issues around surrounding womanhood, excess. I mean, the whole entire show, as we've been setting it up, it has been about organized chaos. It has been about more is better, which is not necessarily something I believe in. There's a lot of work that is in the realm of multiplicity. So we're talking about many, many things.
And get a little more specific because so many of our listeners might not be able to picture what you're talking about.
Okay.
Are the... There's a series you did that is like piles of pastel-colored shoes.
Yes.
Are those in this show?
Yes, they've been recontextualized, so they're a wall work now, but they are in the show. So if one were to come to the show, they would see him very differently than they would see on my website. So we're talking about the same ideas. I'll get really specific so
Please, somebody
understands it. Okay, so you might look at a wall of shoes, like a shoe sale, and you would say, how wonderful, how beautiful, how delicious. I need a shoe. I'm interested in buying a shoe so I can be a shoe collector. And how wonderful that the artist is interested in shoes. Aren't those lovely? But underneath it all, under the, I guess, the underbelly of the work itself, if somebody would really think about it, you'd be looking at shoes that never make pairs. They're only lefts. Or they're only rights, and they're only one size, so you could never make a pair. Each one is unique. Now, what does that talk about? It could talk about a lot of different things to a lot of people, and I'm interested in that idea of multiple points of entry. I want people to come up with their own conclusion, but one could say it's a little bit of social satire or provocation talking about the idea that there's so many shoes and none of them fit together. And we're all...
And they're made out of clay. You cannot wear these.
Exactly. You got it. It's like they're not wearable. Are they art? There's also a label inside that says Misty Gamble, West Palm Beach. And when I was a resident in West Palm Beach, many of my students were from Palm Beach. Wonderful, wonderful people. And I'm not poking fun. It's just social commentary. But tattooed eyebrows, very large rings, really wonderfully educated, smart women that even actually helped me with the work when I was making hands with big diamonds and shoes of the right colors of Palm Beach.
Those colors, they are very, pastel.
You know what? It was April in Palm Beach when I was making that particular installation. And the label itself, Misty Gamble West Palm Beach, it was almost as if I took on the identity of a cobbler in West Palm Beach catering to the women of Palm Beach, which was typically an area where mostly people of color live to cater the women of Palm Beach.
The, you know, those shoes, they're installed, they were previously installed in kind of a jumble or like a pile.
Sure, pile.
And why did you choose to install them differently for this show?
Well, there's still a little pile. I find a lot of interest in, and it keeps me interested in my own work, into redesigning them, reinstalling them. But you will still see a pile if you're at the show. They'll be partly piled. The arrangement, some of them will be lined up, some will be piled.
You were talking about the culture in West Palm Beach a little bit. Mm-hmm. And talk to me a little bit about your own background, like where you are coming from.
Well, I grew up... not only as the child of a father that was an internationally celebrated puppeteer and performer, I spent my summers at puppetry festivals with Jim Henson and Carol Spinney, Big Bird, Bert Tilstrom, and the godfather of puppetry, Bill Baird.
That's such a cool way to grow up.
It was a wonderful experience. At the same time, my dad was an international captain of an airline, Continental Airlines. So we got to fly around. I grew up in Palos Verdes, which is an upper middle class neighborhood. I came out in society as a debutante. And so there was this really strange mixture of, like, well, you could say privilege and theatricality. It was also a very Republican neighborhood in which I grew up. And then at the same time, my father was
in California.
In California, yeah, where I spent the first 40 years of my life. I moved here when I was 40, so I'm talking about my age now, and another decade has gone by. I think a lot of this work has to do, well, with identity and some of my interests of growing up in this fashion. And my father was a provocateur, too.
How did he do it?
He did it through puppetry. He had a nightclub act. He was sort of considered one of the puppeteers to the stars in L.A. He had a stripper and a belly dancer and a drunk, and he—and these were all these very
complicated. The stars have everything, even a puppeteer.
Yeah. And he did these puppet shows for, you know, O.J. Simpson and Ella Fitzgerald. He would come on with these wonderful stories of his conversation with Ella Fitzgerald out in Palm Springs. And I was enamored by him. I was enamored by the performative quality of his work. I would watch him as a child. I looked up to him. And many years went by where I knew that I wanted to be an artist, but I sort of didn't know how or where to start. And I found the immediacy of clay. And I found the ability to make figure.
When did you find that?
Well, I was always a very young artist. I was in my dad's wood shop. Smelling the sawdust was what brought me back, actually, to school. I went back to school at 35 years of age to study art, and I found my way into the wood shop, where there were some mentors of mine that worked in there. And the smell of sawdust, I thought about it. It took me about a year to figure it out. But I was like, why am I so drawn to this space in time now? And it was about a smell, and it was about wood. Yeah.
What had you been doing before that professionally?
For 15 years, I was a booking agent, promoter, publicist, and agent in music and the performing arts. So again, there was that. I've been around arts all my life.
Was it scary to, I mean, artistic skills, people work so diligently
yes.
for so many years, and in many cases from such a young age
yes.
to really hone those skills.
Yes.
Was it intimidating to begin to pursue that really seriously in your mid-30s?
I would say it was courageous.
I would too.
I would say it was almost, I felt like, life or death. It was like I would have put anything and done anything to move forward this. I ran a marathon for the last 10 years to be where I am now.
Describe what you mean a little bit.
It has been a nonstop journey to China twice, Europe four times, 5-6 different residencies, teaching at the Kansas City Art Institute since 2008 as a full-time faculty member.
These things all sound like success. But what do I mean? Talk to me about maybe
what?
Some of the scarier part.
The scarier parts. Well, okay. I like these questions. You're really putting me on the spot, but I'll tell you, for the most part, I've been doing it as a single female woman. Now, that is courageous to crisscross the country 7 times on your own in a van with a lot of stuff from place to place and big art. I've learned how to navigate going back and forth from Europe with airline passes, grants. I've learned how to work with huge teams of people, like we've been doing for the last 4 years. Sounds like it feels like it, but 4 days over at Lidi Volkis Gallery. I've honed my administrative skills. I've been my own promoter, my own publicist. I've mentored people to come work for Misty Gamble Studios. I've created identities. I've designed websites. Those are more successes. But what are the courages, the fears? You know, what is it like to, at 37 years of age, say, you know what? I don't think I'm going to get married and have children. I think I'm going to follow a dream.
What is that like?
It was...
You asked a good question.
It was scary. But it was a decision that, like, women and me, and again, part of these ideas go into my work... I made that decision with full force. I saw what was happening around me. I saw when some of my female, this is getting really personal now, but I saw some of my female friends at 37, 38, 39 scramble around to like date and find a husband, to get married, to fulfill these conventional dreams. And now I wondered at the time, and I wonder now, what... I think it's more important to be happy, to be true, and to be authentic. And I'm reevaluating my life right now. And I think that's why it was important at this time to have this show. It was also in honor of my father, who just passed.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm celebrating him. But through that, I can reevaluate my life and make these decisions now where I want to go from here.
What has it been like to see all of your work from different 10 years is a specific period, but
yes.
But within 10 years, you, I'm sure, see kind of phases. What is it like to see all those phases assembled and to see the last 10 years of your life in kind of a parade?
Yeah. And I've been parading on radio right now. I had another parade. I mean, you know, I'm putting myself out there on Wednesday. I had another interview, and now this exhibit that's going to be there for 3 months, all the way till April 1st. It feels like I am exposing myself, and I want to be as authentic as I can to who I am and putting myself out there.
What do you think your dad would say if he could see this show?
He would say he's so proud of me, of course. And he would say, walk your talk.
Misty Gamble, congratulations on your retrospective. That show is opening tonight at the Leedy Volkus Art Gallery as part of the First Friday's Brouhaha in the Crossroads. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. And before we conclude this morning's art show on KCUR's Central Standard, a little David Bowie, because that is always a good idea. Tomorrow night is the second annual David Bowie tribute show, The Band That Fell to Earth. Last year's show, which was planned before David Bowie died, happened to fall right after the musician's death and ended up being kind of an accidental memorial for local fans. But this year, they're doing it again. Musician and organizer Michelle Bacon, good morning.
Good morning.
What does David Bowie's music mean to you?
You know, David Bowie's music has kind of just been around since I can remember. And Ziggy Stardust was one of the first albums that I was exposed to, and it caused me to really delve into his music and just find what an amazing chameleon, you know, just an all-around artist that he was, and his influence on so many people, so many generations. It's just huge, and you know, for me personally, it's just been a really big deal. So
everything that happened last year turned out to be so crazy.
Yeah, he passed away 3 weeks before our concert. You know, I'd kind of just started planning it because I really wanted to play with these musicians and play this music, and I knew he was coming out with Black Star on his birthday, which is January 8th, and it just kind of snowballed into this crazy thing. You know, so many...
Yeah, you had to switch venues because the original venue wasn't big enough.
Yeah, and it was really just a testament to how much of an influence he was on so many people. You know, we had over 800 people at that show, and so many fans came out.
I want to talk also to Nathan Corsi. He's a vocalist who performed in last year's show, doing a truly uncanny interpretation of Bowie's vocal styling.
Thank you.
He'll be in tomorrow night's show as well. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. What is your relationship with David Bowie's music?
For me, When I was growing up and in middle school and high school, you know, when you're into art and you're into music, you're not necessarily like doing the normal like public school kid things, and you start to feel like an outsider sometimes. And when I would listen to his music with my friends, we would, you know, like it was like being in on a joke. Like an inside joke, like you felt like less of an outsider because, you know, you were listening to an outsider who was actually like one of the coolest people. Yeah, one of the coolest people ever to live. You know, it was like sort of like the manual for being an outsider.
What are some of the joys and maybe challenges of performing the Bowie canon as a vocalist, if I can call it the Bowie canon?
Everything he did sounds really easy. But it turns out that it's incredibly difficult music to sing and to play, And I mean, like, even the vocal stylings, like, there were artists like, you know, Bowie and Lou Reed and Dylan. They did this kind of like talk singing thing, which, like, you know, you're like, oh, it's atonal, like, it shouldn't be that difficult, but it actually like makes the lines more difficult to sing and to phrase, because it takes so much nuance to do like what he was doing.
Let's listen to some music. I want to start with Life on Mars. Let's give it a listen, and we'll come in and talk about this in just a second.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view.
So this song is actually, it has one of my favorite David Bowie qualities. I'm sure there's a better word for it, but I call it the melodrama. I'm always inspired not to dance, but to like pantomime with really dramatic gestures. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
What do you think that the melodrama gives? I mean, the Ziggy Stardust album, I think, is like the quintessential melodrama David Bowie.
Right. I think that kind of harkens back to like that, you know, being like it's like being an outsider. It's like it's not really a unique feeling for, you know, a human being to feel like they're on the outside of something. I think it was his way of relating. You know, it's like when you tell your friends a story, like you're not, you know, you don't tell them like the really like bland version of it, like how it actually happened. It's you know, it's how it happened in your head and how you felt about it. And like he would achieve that in his lyrics with that melodrama.
What do you hear in Life on Mars, Michelle?
You know, I think it really just speaks to the brilliance of his artistry, because that comes from Hunky Dory, which is one of my favorite, probably my favorite Bowie album of all time. And there's so many just kind of like basic folk songs, but then he turns them into these really just dramatic, cathartic things, you know, just adding all those symphonic elements to them.
That's the album with Changes, right?
Yeah, that was his breakout album. 1971, I think.
Well, so that's from a pretty well-known album. Now let's listen to a deeper cut, China Girl. Okay, Michelle, I don't think we can talk about this without addressing what, you know, might sound sort of culturally jarring to people in 2017.
Yeah, you know, again, another example of the way that he used his language to talk about other things. You know, it's really a metaphorical kind of thing. But, yeah, he was just really a chameleon in the way that he wove in language, you know, and really just a great songwriter overall.
This is a dancier song, but the vocals are kind of delicate, or at least that's how I hear them. Is this a challenging song to sing?
You know, I would imagine it is, but thankfully this is one that Stephen Tulipana is going to be singing at the show. He does a lot of the later cuts, and I do a lot of the earlier stuff. It just sort of matches up with our timbre of our voices.
So what are some of the songs that you will be singing?
Life on Mars, which you already played. That's one of my all-time favorite Bowie songs, if not my favorite. I'll be doing Ziggy Stardust this year, Space Oddity. We kind of split up Changes, Gene Genie, Diamond Dogs.
Well,
we split up, yeah.
One of the things that kind of amazes me about Bowie is that there really isn't I mean, you talked about being an outsider in high school and identifying with his music from that perspective, but there really isn't a type of person who listens to Bowie. I mean,
right.
If we're going to put this in crass high school terms, you know, the jocks, the nerds, everyone, there isn't like a category of person who didn't listen to Bowie.
Yeah, there's something for everybody. I've got a friend that, a close friend that said that they didn't like David Bowie, and then I was, you know, and then I'll catch them like humming one of his songs that they weren't aware was something that he wrote, you know, and it really is like, you know, like Michelle has said, like he was a pop chameleon throughout the decades, but he's, you know, he's one of those few artists that like he had a, you know, a top 10 hit every decade until he died. And, you know, he wrote all these different genres of music. Like he was doing weird electronic stuff with Trent Reznor, and he was doing, you know, stuff with Brian Eno during the 70s and 80s, and you know, of Roxy Music, and that's the guy who invented like 3D you know, like three-dimensional sound, and it was, you know, it was like all these weird contexts of music where he was like exploring, but he never really stuck to one thing, and I think that's why so many people like followed at least something that he did in his career.
Michelle, you've talked about Bowie being a chameleon. Is there a period in his career that resonates with you especially?
Well, probably Ziggy Stardust, and you know, a lot of that's because that's the first album that I really dug into with him, and it was during a really, you know, like when I was 18, 19 years old, really formative part of my life. And also, you know, to what Nathan said, the whole outsider feeling and just wanting to be my own individual but not really understanding what that meant, and he really provided the framework for me.
Ziggy Stardust, I mean, that's essentially a story about a character, and it's easy to see that character as just being David Bowie, but
sure.
But maybe not. I mean, what was it in that character or that story? I mean, was it the music or the story, do you think, that resonated with you?
It definitely started more with the music. But, you know, as I think it was more after I delved into his career a little bit more, because right after Ziggy Stardust was Aladdin Sane, but then after, and he was still that character, but then he just totally abandoned it afterwards. And that, to me, was the thing that resonated. It was
the
just
abandoning
like
a character.
Yeah, it was just like, well, he found so much success with this character, and then he just went and did something completely different. He just wasn't afraid to do that, and that was really, really cool to me.
Tell us a little bit more about the character who he ultimately dropped in this, what something that you saw as like courageous.
It was just, you know, Ziggy Stardust, he was an androgynous character. So he just kind of showed us that none of that stuff really mattered, all these conventions that we were wrapped up in and still to an extent are wrapped up in, you know, 30, 40 years later. So I think to me, you know, it was just kind of that quality.
What inspired you to do a second year of the band that fell to earth?
Well, a lot of it was that I really wanted to work with these people again. You know,
the other musicians.
Yeah, the other musicians. We, like, our core group, which includes Nathan.
Getting the band back together.
Yeah. We really bonded over this music because of how important it was to us and how just interesting it was to really get into. So a lot of the impetus was that. But
let's go out on one last Bowie song, Young Americans. Michelle Bacon, musician and mastermind behind the band that fell to earth, and vocalist Nathan Corsi. This has been fun.
This has been great. Thank you, Gina.
Tomorrow night's show is at the Record Bar, and that's a wrap. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tud Hope, and Suzanne Hogan. Linda Scher runs the board for us, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Just behind the bridge, he lays her down. He frowns, to my life's a funny thing.